You're listening to the Write Project podcast and radio program, a show about writing and modern Newfoundland author culture. This program is produced and recorded at CHMR FM 93.5 FM in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, and is aired on other great stations in the province and elsewhere in the country. It can also be heard online at www.chmr.ca. I'm your host, Matthew LeDrew. Okay, we're on the Write Project podcast with famed author and actress Mary Walsh. Hello, Mary.
Hey, Matthew, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful, wonderful. Cool. Mary's on with us because her book, Crying for the Moon, which was a thriller that came out last year?
Yeah, I think last March, maybe.
Oh, yeah, just 2007 it was, yeah.
The March before, yeah.
Crying for the Moon was just shortlisted for the Newfoundland and Labrador Book Awards alongside Joel Thomas Hines and Bridget Canning.
Yep.
I read the book. I absolutely adored every part of it. I love the character of Maureen and everything that she goes through. Well, I don't love everything she goes through, but I love the way that it's... Yeah, I love the
That's
way that it's told.
You know, I'm really happy to hear that because, I mean, a lot of women have said that to me, older women and young women and stuff like that. And I haven't heard that from a lot of men, whether young men or old men, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
I felt like, oh, I think I wrote a book that only women understand because they understand Maureen. But I'm really happy to hear that because I just think she's a human being.
Yeah.
And yeah. And she, you know, she just makes all those mistakes and sometimes that gets on people's nerves, right? That she isn't better.
I don't perceive when I read it, I didn't perceive it as her mistakes per se. Like there was, for instance, it can be hard when writing any character if bad things continue to happen to them. There is a problem of, at some point, it's like you want, even though it's realistic, you almost want the character to be better. You know what I mean? You want them to rise above.
Yes.
But
yeah.
I think when I read it, it was like this window into, this is actually the experience of an entire large, like 50% of our population, is that you just have to put up with the fact that there are very bad men out there and the world is full of not great human beings.
Yeah. And over and over again, you get the message that you are powerless anyway. And so in order to just, you know, stick your courage to the screwing post and do something takes maybe more courage than like the treasure of somebody who was going through it. I'm not, you know what I mean? Because
I do.
Men are expected, they are encouraged, they are, you know, every book is about them, you know, grabbing hold of the sticking post and, you know, going forward and doing the brave thing, right? There's very few books, is there, about men who don't, who don't make the change. Like, and I found with men actually in life, like men, like...
No, go ahead.
If I break up with someone, I mean, this is a long time ago now, so it's all right for me to talk about it. Like, I would often call them up when I got drunk and, you know, like, I found it really hard to move on, right? Like, I was, but I found that men would just, even if they loved you or something and they decided to break up with you, it'd be over. That was mostly with men. I mean, all men are different, obviously.
Yeah.
But there was that thing where you cut it off and it's over and that's done and that door's closed and it won't be opening again. You know what I mean?
I gotta say, that sounds true. I hate that it sounds true, but it sounds true.
Yeah.
Just my very limited experience, I'm thinking
that. And that other opportunities are waiting for them. And, you know, I don't know. I think it's, men are given a whole different message than women. And so poor old Maureen, you know, it took an enormous amount of courage for her to just keep going because she really thought that she was worthless and broken and everything about her was no good, and you know what I mean? So,
I do.
I
adored this book. Can I talk about it a bit if it's not too spoilery? It's right at the beginning. I wanted to ask something. I'm obviously not a writer on your skill level or experience level, but I write a little bit, and when I do, I'm very much a structuralist. Like, I tend to go by the set structure, and then I experiment a little bit within the rules of that. There's a cool thing, or maybe I just haven't had enough experience to learn when to experiment, But there was a cool moment early on. You did the prologue of the book is a flash forward showing, and this is not spoilers because it's the prologue, so
yeah.
It shows Maureen possibly killing her husband, at the very least poisoning her very abusive husband and turning away and leaving.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you something, and if there's no real answer to this, if it's just that's what I decide to do, I will accept that because it's a wonderful book, so whatever you chose to do is fine. But usually when there's a flash forward to something thrilling, if not action-packed, like the poisoning of one's husband, then that flash forward usually is to the end of the third act. You flash forward to four chapters in, and then backtrack to some of Maureen's past, which I love those chapters in Montreal. Those are heartbreaking. But I wanted to ask why the flash forwards there like that. It was such an interesting, like, it made me turn my head and got me very interested because it's a thriller and I love thrillers, but it also played with that convention, and I wanted to know if that was, as soon as I read it, I wanted to get you on and ask you if that was intentional and what
you know, that's really interesting because I'm not much of a structuralist, and that's where I've always been weak, really, in all my writing, like in except the structure of a sketch, I guess. I'm pretty good on, I whatever reason, I suppose I've been doing it now for so long. But, you know, structure is so important in screenplays. Like, it's so rigid. It's like writing a sonnet, you know. Yep. It's so rigid. I felt the novel, even though I know there is a recognized structure to thrillers and all that, but I felt so free when I wrote the novel. And really, who inspired me was like Dickens, and I know it's a different time and people don't have time for that, but like he would, like in Great Expectations, Pip would go off with the guy, the clerk from the lawyer's clerk, and they'd go down to his father's, the place he'd built for his father, and they spend a lot of time down there talking to the father about nothing, you know, that had anything to do with what was coming. And I mean, I'm not saying that I did that because I don't think, because Dickens was, of course, writing in a daily newspaper and was being paid by the word. So, you know, it was to his advantage. But the freedom that you feel sometimes when you read a Dickens novel, and everyone doesn't feel this way when they read Dickens. Some people feel, oh, I can't believe that we're going there now.
I agree with you, actually.
I feel that sense of freedom. And so, in a way, that's the way I wrote the book, too. You know what I mean? I didn't embrace anybody's structure. I just tried to tell the story in the best way that I could, and I really wanted to be more experimental, but then I realized that it was really getting in the way of, you know, there's a guy, oh my god, he wrote about the Yorkshire murders, and it was like reading James Joyce and Ian Rankin, like some mix between James Joyce and Ian Rankin, and you never really knew, like the thriller was so thrilling, you never really knew what was going on. Like, apparently in the Yorkshire, you know, the Yorkshire killer guy, the police were so corrupt that they murdered some people in Yorkshire during the Yorkshire Ripper time.
Wow.
And to make it look like the Ripper, right?
That's intense. And this is all documented.
But this is a novel, so it's like, you don't know where you are half the time, but it's so exciting. I forget the name. He wrote a trilogy called Red Something or Other, and it was all about the Yorkshire Ripper, but it was so exciting. I really wanted to do something like that, but I realized I didn't have the skill sets, you know, for it, really, because it was confusing me after a while with myself, whereas I didn't mind being confused by this guy, like, that, you know, some of the, like, I didn't know whether it was the Yorkshire Ripper who was killing people, or whether it was the cops who was doing it, or what was going on, but it was so well done that you were with it 100%, right?
That's actually my favorite part. I read a lot of thrillers. I that's the genre I attempt to write in. I'm going to say attempt because, you know, but it's yours is, I think, is one of the best ones I've read in, I'd say, 10 years. And part of it is because it doesn't follow that structure. Like so much of thrillers are so structured that, like, it's so, I mean, you'll know this from writing in screenplay and television, the whole setup, remind, payoff, setup, remind, payoff.
That pattern. I know. And it gets tiresome after a while.
I know, but with thrillers, you've read so many that, like, when you see the setup and then you see the remind, you can guess the payoff, and you don't even need to read the rest of the book.
Right. Yep. Well, because here's another thing that, you know, I started out the book as a kind of coming-of-age thing. And, you know that woman, Roz Chast, she's a cartoonist. She does a lot of cartoons, and they're different panels. You know, she'll have 6 or 8 panels in one cartoon. But anyway, she did this thing, the growth of a reader or a reader's life or something. It was in the New Yorker maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And so there's, you know, Roz Chast as a little girl reading, you know, Trixie Belden and Nancy Drew. And then there she is reading, you know, Doris Lessing. And there she is reading, you know, Dostoevsky. And there she is at around 50, starting to read mystery books again. Like, you know, she starts off and it's all a big return, you know, like at 50, she's reading mystery books, but she's not admitting it. At 60, she's just out and out reading, you know, Scandinavian noir and Ian Rankin and stuff. And sort of it happened to me too, in just exactly that way. Like, I started off with Trixie Belden and Nancy Drew and all those, and the Hardy Boys and all those guys, and Ginny Gordon and, oh my God, Cherry Ames and all those books. And then really was not interested in penny dreadfuls and mysteries and thrillers and stuff. Really not interested at all.
Yeah.
For many years, and felt quite contemptuous of them. You know what I mean?
I do.
And then found my way back to them, and now, you know, spend a good bit of my reading time reading them.
Yeah.
And so after I got through some of the book, I realized that I wanted to tell, you know, I wanted that to be in there. I wanted some aspect of a thriller to be in there, some aspect of what I was actually interested in at that point to be in there, right? Yeah.
I always look at it as like the very typical hardcore lit novel that might get put up for award. They have something to say, and that's great. This novel and many others, and more thrillers than I think people give credit for, something happens and they have something to say. Like, just because there's cool stuff happening doesn't mean it can't also have something cool to say.
Exactly. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. So I'm so thrilled that you like the book. That gives me so much pleasure. I'm thrilled also to be shortlisted, you know, with Joel and Bridget. So, you know.
That actually lets me to the question I'm asking everyone. Have you had a chance to read any of the other novels, be it ones that you're shortlisted with or from other categories or whatever?
I've read both Bridget's and Joel's, and find them, you know, both amazing books. I think Joel really, I mean, I've read all Joel's work, you know, he's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
I think this was a step outside of what he was doing with Down to the Dirt and Right Away Monday and those other books. And he kind of went somewhere else with this. And I found that really interesting and really good. And Joel considers it to be a funny book. I don't consider it to be a funny book at all, and neither does his father. I said to Joel's father, and Joel's father said, you know, because, you know, right off the bat, there's only one ending for that young fellow, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not like, you know, right off the bat, and it's like, oh, well, I don't have to read the book, because you do. But it's just like that rising sense of dread you have all the time, and it's so well done in that way, and you know. And he's fine, you know, he's so lacking in hope, and yet he's ever hopeful that he will do this thing, you know, and it's just really brilliantly done, I think. And Bridget's book, this is the first book I read by her, and it's wonderful. And she's just put out another book about things that are written on the ladies' room wall.
I've picked that one up.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting that too. Yeah,
it's amazing. You should read it. It's amazing. I was actually talking to her about that, but it's just a photo book of graffiti written in ladies' rooms, ladies in gender neutral rooms, and sometimes there's accompanying fiction along with it. There's only about 6 short stories in it, varying in page length and stuff like that. But the main draw is just these odd things that were written. Things that are written in the ladies' room.
You know, it's interesting. We started Kodko in 1973 in Toronto. We went over to the Imperial Room, and we were writing, and there on the in the ladies' room of the Imperial Room, that it read, "The wild cod lie dead in the ocean, the wild cod lie dead in the sea," and that was it. And I said, oh my God. And at that time, the idea of it being wild cod seemed really ridiculous. And that they and that there would be, that they would be dead seemed totally ludicrous. But we wrote a song called "The Wild Cod Lie Dead," all caused by, they all died of water pollution caused by the oil industry. Yeah. And then we had this big you know, thing. But yeah, it's like interesting. Hey, the stuff you pick up on the bathroom wall. I mean, it was so prophetic. And when we wrote it, it seemed ridiculous that we would ever get to that place of 1992. It seemed beyond imagining,
yep,
that we could come to a place like that where the wild cod did lie dead in the ocean.
Yeah. Which, yeah, which now it's quaint that we ever thought it wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Time,
yeah,
is not kind to our expectations.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk in the book. I'm sorry to keep coming back to, I'm talking more about yours, no, I think. But in the novel, the first few chapters take place in Montreal. Am I remembering that correctly? I don't,
yes,
have it in front,
yeah,
of me.
Yeah, Montreal during Expo.
Yes, during Montreal Expo.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting moment. I feel like this is intentional. I've been fortunate enough to seen some of your work before, and I believe this is intentional. But there, it takes place in the 60s during the Montreal Expo there. And there's a moment where these two young ladies from Maureen and her friend, what was her friend's name, I'm sorry?
Carlene,
yes. Yeah. Where they're at, they sneak out, they're there for a choir, for a, like a Catholic church choir, and they sneak out at night and they go to a club. And they very obviously, to us, in our eyes, get taken advantage of. Like, they are drinking a fair bit and being kind of plied with alcohol, even though they're underage and they've been let into this club because the club owner likes Newfoundland girls. And
yes,
then they wake up with two people who work at the club, and their apartment, yeah, was just upstairs. Sorry, spoilers. I found it, what I found really interesting about that is that you very much put it in the point of view of the time. Like, me reading it now, I can look at it and go, like, especially in the last few years with the Me Too movement and all that, but even beyond that, like, it's obvious what's happening.
Yeah.
But it's not obvious to the characters what's happening. Like, it's not obvious to Maureen never brings up, at least at that point, that she's been taken advantage of. She doesn't think of it in that way. And for someone, I was born in 84, so I was, and I, my parents were, and my household was thankfully fairly modern. It's always interesting to look back and go, in within living memory, this happened and people didn't even think on it.
No, because it was the 60s, it was the summer of love. Maureen was desperate to take part in all of that. It was a whole forward thing. And to have free love was considered to, was a terrible time for women. Women just got taken advantage of, and you didn't think you were worth anything, and you had to bang everybody. And you know what I mean? Shulamith Firestone started the women's movement in an apartment in New York because they were, all the women who were part of the movement of, you know, civil rights and anti-Vietnam War, like, they were just making, bringing coffee and stuff like that. And so Shulamith Firestone said, let's have our own meeting. And the guys from the, you know, from, came over and went, what are you doing? What are you doing over here? They went, we're having a women's meeting. And they went, what do you have to have a women's meeting for? You know, get back over there and make the coffee.
Yeah.
And, but they didn't. And it went on from there, right? And the, yeah, women's movement's kind of, the second wave of the women's movement kind of started in a, you know, in an apartment in New York. So young girls like Maureen, who didn't think much of herself anyway,
yeah,
counted themselves lucky to get laid. And then once they did it, they kind of thought, well, who am I to say no now that I've said yes, now that I've committed the great sin anyway?
Yeah.
I might as well go on. So it was almost like, I don't think that Maureen felt, it's like I've often said that nobody at Holy Heart, if they went to Mercy anyway, would ever have gotten laid in 1967 if it hadn't been for booze. Like, we never, I don't know, maybe there were some really brave girls, you know, but just the body shame, the spirit shame, the soul shame, the sin was so great that you just wouldn't be able to do it if you weren't loaded, you
wow.
know? So it's complex, right? It's complex, and when you look at it through the lens of Me Too, which I did not do, you can see that man, but even we could see that even Maureen sees that the guy who owns the club is definitely taking advantage of Carlene, right?
But that's what's really interesting about the book, and that's such an interesting comment, because she can see it in someone else, but not in herself.
Not in herself at all, no.
Yeah.
No.
It's masterfully written. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed it. You're right in that you didn't bring a modern sensibility to it. Even in not acknowledging that, there kind of was, in that modern readers can't shed the baggage of the current climate when you go up to pick up any work of fiction. You know what I mean?
Right. No, exactly. But, you know, it was quite shocking for me, even writing it, to realize that when Maureen was getting the kicked out of her, there really was nothing in place to protect her.
Yeah.
Anyway, right? But as it being her own fault, and the police would, you know, they wouldn't do anything. There were no charges laid unless the woman herself laid the charges, right?
Yep.
Well, I am so thrilled that you like the book. That is the biggest thing that happened. That's the best thing that happened.
I can't stop recommending it to people, honestly.
Oh,
like, I've given it to my sister now, and she's an avid thriller reader, and she's going through it, and it's going to... That one copy I got is going to make its rounds, but I'm also just selling everyone I can on it, because I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Oh, great. Thank you, Matthew.
No problem. What's the first book, if you can remember, or the first book in memory, that made you cry?
Heidi and her relationship with her grandfather, that really, when he said goodbye to her, when they took her away, that made me cry.
Yes.
And it's the first book I remember making me cry.
Heidi, that's the one, it got adapted by Shirley Temple, right?
Yes, the movie, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
So we're talking about the same thing. Okay, sounds good. Yeah, no, that's huge. Does writing energize you, or does it exhaust you?
Well, if I get it right, it energizes me. But sometimes, you know, you can write away at things and it'll feel like, you know, you're just not getting it right. You're not doing what you want to do, you know. And sometimes it feels like trying to get it right is as thin as a knife edge. You know what I mean? You just can't get on there. And then that is exhausting, right? And so that's it. So depending on how it goes, if it goes well, I find it extraordinarily exhilarating. But if I'm not getting at it, I find it exhausting.
Yeah, absolutely. As you would.
Yeah.
Yeah. In your opinion, does having a big ego help authors, or does it hurt them?
Well, you know, all those authors that I read when I was young, all those women-hating authors, Norman Mailer, et cetera, having a big ego didn't seem to hurt them at all. You know, all of the 20th century American male authors, but, you know, like people like Kurt Vonnegut, who I loved when I was young, he didn't seem to suffer from an overinflated ego, so... You know, I think it's helped and harmed. It can help and harm, right? It can help you sell your books, I guess, but whether or not it actually helps you touch actual human beings, I'm not sure, you know?
There's a weird logic. I was talking about this with another author that was on, but in some respects, to be an author, you almost have to have an incredible ego, because just the experience of saying, you should pay money for my thoughts... is kind of egotistical. Like,
I suppose, except that, you know, like if you're a big reader and an author and you wait a long time to write, then really all your, I suppose in a way you're right, but to me what I was trying to do, and I didn't manage to do it this time, but I was trying to find myself and the people I knew and my class and my experience in books. Now, I found bits and bobs of myself, and certainly the most I found of our family was in House of Hate, which is a hard thing to say.
Yeah.
But, you know, just that kind of sarcastic, mean kind of family, you know, you don't see that in literature very much. And there they were, you know.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to, you know, there's us. It's like not just me. I don't want just me. I want us, like our crowd, to be, you know, for people to see us. And, you know, and then if you don't know anyone like us, I guess maybe... It's not, you know, like we tend to Like, how much do we know about the Queen and them, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and Donald Trump and the people with money and the people in the middle class. We spend a long time since the 50s, you know, studying the middle class on TV, seeing their mores, learning the how you do it. You know what I mean? It's been a great, great teacher to the working poor, how to be middle class if you've ever managed to get there.
Yeah.
But, you know, not since, you know, where are we hearing our voice? Where are we seeing our people? Where are we seeing our experience? So in a way, too, I think that, you know, you think of people like Michael Crummy, or you think of people like Lisa Moore. It's not just, I feel, I don't know, I've never had the conversation with them, or Joel, but like, they don't just want it to be, they want the voices that they know. They want their experience and their crowd and their people to be seen. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
If you could go back in time and tell your younger writing self any one thing, what would that be?
You know, I guess it's the same old message that you just keep hearing all the time, and I just have to keep hearing it all the time, that there's no point in trying to write like someone else. There's no point in trying to be who you're not. There's only point is to be who you are and to write what you write like and to share your experience, strength, and hope, I suppose, or whatever. You know what I mean?
I
have to write out loud, because I often find when I put on my writerly cap and just write away, it often sounds a bit pretentious and not like myself. And, you know, I'd love to be Coetzee, you know, I'd love to be him. I'd love to be able to write more in one sentence than most people could write in an entire book, but I'm not him.
I'm thankful you're not him. I like you the way you are.
Okay. Well, that's good. But yeah, that's what I just say, that thing that we're always trying to be what we're not. And just to, you know, every day make the effort to be yourself, you know, to thine own self be true, you know.
What is your favorite underappreciated novel?
My favorite underappreciated novel? Well, I think all the novels of Faye Weldon, really. Like, because she's always sort of dismissed as a chick lit kind of person. And it's like, I just read her latest novel, which is about getting old, and I thought, wow, here I am reading Faye Weldon, and I'm learning things about growing old. And it was like, you know, and when I was in the early 70s and was just a young woman, you know, maybe an old teenager and a young woman, I learned how to be that with Faye Weldon and Doris Lessing and, you know, all that crowd, right? But I don't think people don't speak of Faye Weldon anymore. Doris Lessing won the Nobel Prize, right? And so she's recognized, but Faye Weldon is kind of forgotten. People are remembering Colette again, which is good. And Jean Rees, oh my God, and nobody talks about her. The Wide Sargasso Sea, one of the best novels. It's Mr. Rochester's wife it's from her point of view, and she's from the island, you know, from one of the Caribbean islands, and is locked up in that attic. It's a great Jean Rees. So all those people I read when I was coming round, yep. Growing up.
As a writer, if you had to choose a mascot or spirit animal, what would it be?
Caribou. It's a caribou.
Okay.
I mean, we actually met one on the trail in Gros Morne. And how could we have ever changed our provincial animal from a caribou, the magnificent caribou, to a puffin? When did we become cute?
I don't know. I think we're trying to Disneyfy ourselves for the tourism.
Really, caribou.
Have you ever Googled yourself?
I don't very often, but when occasionally I have, when I did my one-woman show, and when the book came out, I did, just to see if there was anything on there, any reviews or anything. I got very little in the way of reviews. Joan Sullivan gave me a fabulous review, and I got a review in the Atlantic Press and stuff. But nationally, I didn't get much in the way of reviews, which, you know, well, there you go. I mean, I guess people aren't that... There's not that much national coverage anyway of anything, is there? I mean, there was only the Globe and Mail, and they're not national at all anymore. And
honestly,
you know,
it's hard to get people to write reviews of thrillers. it is genuinely difficult. Like, people love to read them, but to get people to sit up afterwards and write a review, whether a lit fiction thing, like the type of person who's attracted to lit fiction, they are sit there like, they're like, oh, I have read this and now I have an opinion, and they want to share their opinion to be almost be
part of the
narrative.
Okay.
Like, it is darn difficult to get people to write a review of a thriller, but you'll have to solace yourself that you'll sell 1,000 times more copies. Thank you, Mary, for coming on the Write Project podcast.
Oh, thank you very much, Matthew, for having me.
No problem. Anytime.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on again. For all of you, we'll be here again next week at 4:30 Newfoundland time or online at chmr.ca. Please tune in and we'll talk more about writing culture in Newfoundland.